You're listening to a talk given by Scott Ritter on December 3rd in Binghamton, New York. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests.
We find a facility. We think it's Saddam's bodyguard unit. We go in, hit it hard with an inspection, and see how the Iraqis respond. We have a U-2 aircraft doing a figure eight over Baghdad taking photographs. We have inspectors with earphones on dialing into the radio traffic, listening to how the Iraqis respond, and we get a baseline of information. Then we hit another facility and another, and we start comparing how the Iraqis respond, isolating the nodes that appear each time. And we focus in on them and continue to do the inspection. You know, it's a pretty effective means, except for one thing. We're really irritating the Iraqis. See, our job is to disarm Iraq. And Iraq is very concerned that we're being used by the United States for other purposes. Remember America's policy, regime removal. Get rid of Saddam Hussein. Every president since George Herbert Walker Bush has signed a finding, a lethal finding, authorizing the CIA to get rid of Saddam Hussein, including using direct action means that result in his death. The Iraqis know this. The CIA from 1993 to 1996 sponsored at least three coup attempts against Saddam Hussein. They all failed. Why? Saddam Hussein's got one of the most brutally efficient security apparatuses the world's ever seen. Suddenly, you got UN weapons inspectors investigating this very same security apparatus. And the Iraqis are getting nervous about this. So the Iraqis put a halt to it. They say, time out, you can't continue. Well, we go to the Iraqis and say, you got to let us go. You know, that's our job, to do the inspections. So we cut a deal. We call it the Sensitive Site Modalities Agreement. Inspectors go to a site like a bodyguard unit or a palace that the Iraqis declare to be sensitive, knock on the door, the Iraqis say, this is a sensitive site. That limits the number of inspectors that can go into four. So the inspectors go in, do their job. If they find anything related to weapons of mass destruction, they leave. If they find nothing related to weapons of mass destruction, they leave. If we found something related to weapons of mass destruction, the whole team comes in. That was the deal. That's how we did business. You know, and it worked pretty good. It worked from 1996 to 1998. Few hiccups here and there, but it worked. Of course, functioning is the last thing the United States wants. We don't want a functioning weapons inspection program. See, as the inspectors start to investigate this concealment mechanism, we do this giant frog experiment, we get the Iraqis to twitch, we start finding out that what they're protecting isn't weapons of mass destruction. What they're concealing isn't weapons of mass destruction. They're protecting the president. They're protecting Saddam Hussein's security. They're concealing information about the president's security. The inspectors are starting to realize that, you know, we've succeeded. We've accomplished the mission. There probably isn't anything in there left to find. And that's a finding the United States government simply could not tolerate. The United States government now has a problem. And the problem isn't Iraq. The problem is the weapons inspectors. How to deal with the weapons inspectors? Now, it's sort of a quandary. Do you shut them down? That would be useful, but if you shut them down, you no longer gather this good intelligence about this Saddam Hussein's security. So you have to keep the inspections going, but they have to be going in a way that isn't confrontational, doesn't create a problem, that doesn't bring closure to this issue. The United States starts manipulating the inspection process. From November 1997 to August 1998, seven inspections, which I was the leader of, were interfered with by the United States of America. You know, when you do an inspection, you have a search warrant. It's a document signed by the chief executive that allows us to go in and do an inspection. We call it a notification of inspection site. I would show up at a facility with a search warrant. That means I'm allowed to inspect the site. The United States would revoke the search warrant. The United States revoking a United Nations search warrant because it was politically inconvenient for the inspection to take place at this time. And yet the United States wanted us to go into certain sites that had nothing to do with arms control to gather intelligence about Saddam Hussein's security. Well, I have to tell you, as a weapons inspector, this was unacceptable to me. That's why I chose to resign in August 1998. I can no longer do my job. My job was to inspect, and the United States wouldn't let me inspect. Iraq wouldn't cooperate, and the Security Council wouldn't enforce. It was an untenable situation, and I walked. But the inspector still stayed in place. In December 1998, the final corruption occurred. The United States used the weapons inspectors, manipulated one last time, send them into Baghdad to go to a sensitive site called the Adamiya Ba'ath Party headquarters. Yeah, I said Ba'ath Party. It's a political party in Iraq. It's like the Republican Party or Democratic Party. It's not a weapons of mass destruction site. The inspectors showed up, and the Iraqis went, "This is a sensitive site. The modalities apply." Normally, that would be it. You know, the Iraqis actually opened the door and said, "Inspect us, please." But the United States had a little trick up its sleeve. They put pressure on the UN weapons inspectors to unilaterally withdraw from the sensitive site modalities. Right there, without telling the Security Council. The inspector said, "I'm sorry, the modalities no longer apply. We're going in with everybody." The Iraqis said, "Well, you can't do that. We had an agreement. You're welcome to come in with your four. We'll give you 16 inspectors. Come on in. But the modalities apply." U.S. said no. The Iraqis said, "If the modalities don't apply, then there is no inspection." The United States said, "Great." Cited Iraq as being non-compliant. And, you know, there's a mythology out there that maybe the Iraqis kicked the weapons inspectors out. You probably heard that. Saddam Hussein kicked the inspectors out. No. They were ordered out by the United States. Peter Burley, the deputy ambassador, picked up the phone and talked to Richard Butler, Australian diplomat who ran the program, and said, "Get your inspectors out." Richard Butler withdrew the inspectors, citing Iraqi noncompliance, and less than 24 hours later, the United States bombed Iraq. Operation Desert Fox. They used the information gathered by our frog experiment about Saddam Hussein's security to target Saddam Hussein. Desert Fox, you know, the president of the United States then, Bill Clinton, said that Desert Fox was about taking out Iraq's weapons of mass destruction program. Of 97 targets hit, 11 dealt with industrial facilities that could be used by Iraq to produce weapons of mass destruction, but we knew they weren't because we had monitors there. But they were bombed anyways. 86 targets dealt with Saddam Hussein. Operation Desert Fox was a concerted effort by the United States to eliminate Saddam Hussein. They failed. Saddam survived. But you know what didn't survive? The weapons inspection process. You see, the inspectors have been exposed to being nothing more than facilitators of unilateral American policy objectives of regime removal. The inspectors were shown to be something other than that which had been mandated by the Security Council. The inspectors had been disgraced. The inspectors had been corrupted. And Iraq said the inspectors aren't allowed back in. And that's the situation we faced for 4 years with inspectors outside Iraq. Now we have inspectors back inside Iraq. And you know, they're doing a pretty interesting job. They're going to a facility, they're knocking on the door, and the door opens. And the Iraqis give them their full cooperation. The Security Council has told Iraq that there will be no tolerance for a return to the obstruction of the past, the cheat and retreat, the hide and seek, the concealment. You now have two elements in place for a successful inspection regime. Inspectors going in, getting full cooperation, a Security Council prepared to enforce its law. But we still have in place that one corrupting element called American policy of regime removal. Getting rid of Saddam Hussein, that is still America's policy. And unfortunately, President Bush appears to be using the weapons inspection process simply as a vehicle to justify yet another military engagement with Iraq. So we're getting ready to go to war against Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. The president the other day said he's not satisfied with the cooperation the inspectors are getting. I mean, Bush won't take yes for an answer, apparently. You know, and we appear to be hell-bent for leather to go to war with Iraq. Well, you have to ask yourself, why are we going to war with Iraq? Is it about weapons of mass destruction? Well, if it is, shouldn't we let the inspectors do their job? It's curious that this past October, Donald Rumsfeld sent a briefing team up to brief the American public. They put photographs up there that showed facilities in Iraq. A vaccination plant, they said, we know Iraq is producing anthrax at this place. A missile plant, they're producing long-range missiles. A machinery plant, they're producing centrifuges for nuclear enrichment. Well, the inspectors have gone to all of these facilities. They got full cooperation. They found nothing there. Not only did they find nothing there now, but they found that nothing's been going on there for 4 years. So what were these photographs that Donald Rumsfeld put up before the American public? A fabrication? A lie? I think so. The president today will tell you that Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. On Sunday, Iraq's supposed to submit a declaration listing the totality of its weapons. What if Iraq says, we don't have any? But the inspectors are welcome to come in and investigate, and we'll give them their full cooperation. The president says, that's unacceptable. Iraq must acknowledge having these weapons, even if they don't exist. You know, and it's curious, because, you know, I always believe in the rule of law. You know, if you're going to... you're going to go after somebody and say that they're, you know, you suspect them of committing a crime. Don't you have to provide evidence of that crime before you convict? I would think so, but we've actually convicted Saddam Hussein, found him guilty, and applied the death penalty regime removal before we've gathered evidence to convict him of a crime. It's stunning, but we don't need evidence. I mean, just ask Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of Defense. He went to NATO last spring. The NATO allies said, hey, give us the evidence that Iraq has these weapons. Donald Rumsfeld said, well, you know, evidence, evidence. He said, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. Laugh you may, but ladies and gentlemen, we're going to war. We're going to war because of this. And this is going to be a war the likes of which we haven't seen in some time. This isn't going to be a video game. This is going to be thousands of Americans dying. This is going to be about fighting a battle in Baghdad, a city the size of Detroit, 5 million people, former military commanders of Central Command, Marine generals, Vietnam veterans, not cowards, have said if we go to war in Baghdad, if we fight in the streets of Baghdad, we will lose one battalion of troops a day. That's 800 Americans a day. For what? For Iraqi weapons of mass destruction? You know, it's curious. North Korea said they got a nuclear bomb. They said that, you know, the hell with inspections, you can't come in. And how are we dealing with the North Koreans? Diplomatically. Iraq says, we don't have any weapons, but send in your inspectors, and how are we going to deal with them? We're going to war. Is this really about weapons of mass destruction? Is this about a threat that Iraq poses to the American people? I think not. This is about something different. And what it is something that should be very disturbing to every American in this audience. I asked you to read the Constitution. I'm going to ask you to read another document called the National Security Strategy Document put forth by the Bush administration in September of this year. It speaks of a new policy of American unilateralism. It says that the United States will take advantage of our overwhelming military and economic strength to impose our will unilaterally on problems around the world that we unilaterally define. It says, amazingly enough, that we will not tolerate competition. That if anybody tries to become our equal, we'll view this as a threat to our national security, and we will preemptively strike them in violation of international law. It is a rejection of multilateralism. It is a rejection of international law. You can call it unilateralism. I'll give it another term. Imperialism. American imperialism. And I'll tell you this. I didn't put on a uniform to defend my country if we become an imperial power. You know, we fought a revolutionary war 220 some odd years ago to free ourselves from an imperial power, and yet that's what we're becoming today. This is a very disturbing thing. Americans are going to be asked to go off and fight and die in Iraq because we are pursuing the politically motivated ideology of a handful of neoconservatives that hijacked the national security-making hierarchy of the United States. That is not the worth the blood of any American. Now, what are we doing about it? You know, we call ourselves a democracy. Are we a democracy? You know, let's talk about war with Iraq. The key to a democracy, one of the keys is accountability, holding people accountable. But let's talk about war. You know, was war allowed to be discussed during this last election? No. The president maneuvered to get Congress to abrogate their constitutional duties to declare war, to give the president war powers authority without the American people allowing to weigh in. If you call up your congressmen and senators, you'll find out that they were getting phone calls 300, 500, 1,000 to 1 against the war, and yet they voted for the war. Is that democracy? Is there accountability? You know, think about it. When we go to war with Iraq, there's only the controls in the hands of one man. One man alone has the capability to make the determination whether we go to war or not. That's President Bush. This isn't a democracy. This is a dictatorship. A dictatorship of one. So what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it? What are you going to do about it? Don't blame the American government. You're the American government. It's our fault. It's our collective responsibility what's taking place. What are we doing about it? As I said before, you can't do anything about it unless you allow yourself to discuss the issue. And that's why I'm grateful for you being here tonight. This is a beginning, I hope, of a larger debate and a dialogue. I hope you leave here tonight disturbed and challenged by what I've had to say. You don't have to agree with me. But I certainly hope that you leave here saying, hey, we need to know more about this issue. We have to become involved. We have to hold our elected representatives accountable for what they do in our name, or we cease to function as a democracy. We cease to function as the United States of America that was framed by our founding fathers when they wrote that Constitution a couple hundred years ago. Now, in keeping with the promise of accountability, I'm now going to shut up and allow myself to be held accountable by you for what I've said tonight. Thank you very much. Thanks.
Hi. Can everyone hear me? Great. In 1998, you're quoted as saying, this is 1998, Iraq can in a very short period of time, measure the months, reconstitute chemical biological weapons, long-range ballistic missiles to deliver those weapons, and even certain aspects of their nuclear weaponization program. That was 4 or 5 years ago. There's been no inspections except for 6 days. How can you be so sure that they don't have weapons of mass destruction? You even admitted 5 to 10%, which could really be 15 to 20%. How can you be so sure?
Oh, I really apologize if I gave you the impression that I was so sure. Let's just backtrack for a second and go to 1998. Thank you very much for taking the time to do the research. I think you'll find that when I testified before the U.S. Senate, what I said is that within a period of 6 months, once you withdraw weapons inspectors from Iraq, Iraq could reconstitute significant aspects of its weapons programs. Now, this is sound scientific fact based upon my experience 7 years in Iraq, and I stand by that today. Within 6 months of inspectors being withdrawn from Iraq, Iraq could reconstitute. That's why it's extremely important that we have weapons inspectors back into Iraq. And since 1998, I have been struggling very hard to get inspectors back on the ground, inspectors that work, inspectors that don't have to worry about Iraqi obstruction, inspectors that have the full support of the international community, inspectors that will not be manipulated by the United States for purposes of regime removal. We now have inspectors in place. I don't think I said 6 days is enough. I think what you have to understand is that 6 months isn't enough. This is a process that will have to take time. Give the inspectors time. I'm not giving Iraq a clean bill of health. I've already stood here and told you that I've accused Iraq of the crime of possessing weapons of mass destruction. I've told you that, you know, there's 5 to 10% out there that we can't account for. So we need to have the inspectors on the ground doing their job of disarming Iraq. That's what it's about, letting the inspectors be inspectors. But, again, what do you want? Want to go to war? You want to send...
Tell the truth on December 7th.
If the Iraqis don't tell the truth by December... How many people here are willing to die if the Iraqis don't tell the truth by December 7th? Come on, raise your hands. How many mothers are willing to give your son? You're willing to die if the Iraqis don't tell the truth. I hope you've signed up, and I wish you Godspeed, sir. But I tell you what, while you may want to die, I have friends in the Marine Corps that I don't want to have them die. As an American citizen, I will do whatever I can to keep those boys home away from going to war. Until we find that Iraq represents a threat to the United States of America worthy of that sacrifice. You say Iraq has to tell the truth on December 7th. If they tell the international community that they don't have any weapons, you say they're lying?
I want to ask this audience, how many in the audience think Iraq is going to lie on December 7th based on Scott Ritter's talk?
Well, I think they're going to lie.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, but my point is, I'm not going to go to war because of that. I think they're going to lie. I think you might have sold drugs. I think you might have done something.
I know they're going to lie, and so do you.
No. The due process of law. You have to have the evidence to convict them of the crime before you send the troops in. Let's let the inspectors find out what's going on before we ask Americans to die.
On September 11th, after the attacks, there were no planes allowed in the sky. On September 12th, the Bin Laden family was flown out of the United States, the only plane allowed to fly. And in this country, when there's a murder, the first people you talk to are the family members. Why was the Bin Laden family flown, in your opinion? Why were they allowed to be flown that day?
I don't know. That's a good question to ask your elected representatives in the U.S. government. What I would say is this, though. You know, we talk about the war on terror, and you hear the Bush administration make a lot of reference to Iraq as being a key element to win this war on terror, that we can't win the war on terror till we go in and remove Saddam Hussein from power. But when you take a look at the facts, there is no linkage between Saddam Hussein and those who perpetrated the events of September 11th. You know, it's funny, though, when you get a poll of the American public, 80% of the American public believes that there is such a linkage. 80%. And when you ask them why, they say, you know, that's because Mohammed Atta, one of those hijackers, he met with an Iraqi intelligence official in Prague, Czechoslovakia. We read about it in the New York Times. We heard about it on Fox News. Well, it turns out that that meeting never took place, but it had been repeated enough times that it's embedded in the psyche of the American public. They're convinced that this meeting took place, that there is such a linkage. So we're going to go to war against Iraq because Iraq is somehow affiliated with the perpetrators of the events of September 11th. You know, President Bush said in the war on terror, if you fund terror, you're a terrorist. And if you give training to terrorists, you're a terrorist. Well, let's take a look at a couple things. The number one funder of Al-Qaeda is the Saudi Arabian government. Are we going to war against Saudi Arabia? I think not. The number one provider of training is Pakistan. I mean, Pakistan, our close ally in the war on terror, is the same Pakistan that provided nuclear weapons technology to North Korea in exchange for North Korean ballistic missile technology after September 11th. So I'm a little confused about what's going on. I share your confusion. You know, if you want to talk to the suspects, why'd we let them fly out of the country? You know, when you're saying 15 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, you know, that might point that maybe the problem resides more in Saudi Arabia than it does in Iraq. And yet we're going to go to war with Iraq.
Hello from a fellow Capital District resident. You mentioned before that the many military officers and also former military officers have been very critical of the plans to go to war with Iraq. It's been my perception that many of the gung-ho hawks in the Bush administration and also among the pundits are individuals who, for better terms, declined to serve or have never served in the military or have had no experience, who have not had the experience of warfare that you've had. Do you find that's your perception? Does it break down along those lines?
Well, unfortunately, yes. I mean, I see that, you know, Dick Cheney, the vice president, found Vietnam to be inconvenient to him. And yet he's going to make Iraq very convenient to a whole bunch of 20-year-olds. President Bush found it more convenient to fly F-102s over Houston, Texas, than he did to fly F-4 Phantom strike missions in Vietnam. And yet he's very gung-ho about sending our troops in. Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz, two of the biggest hawks, you know, I don't even think played athletics, let alone, you know, find the war. But let me say this, though. I don't believe that military service is a litmus test for government service. You know, I'm not one of these people that says you have to serve in the military to lead the American public. Not at all. But I would say this, that if you chose not to serve, and that's your right, and you're now in a position where you're going to lead American troops as commander-in-chief, you better damn well listen to those who did serve. And when you got four-star generals who are not cowards, men who have served in combat, men who know what death and destruction is, men who know what it means to write a letter home to Mr. and Mrs. Smith explaining why their son, Lance Corporal Smith, is dead and why he died. And they're sitting there telling you, boss, this is not a good thing. This is a stupid war. We don't need to fight this war. If you go to war in Baghdad, we're going to lose 800 men a day. You know, as the president, you better listen to these people. You better pay heed. When you hear the director of the CIA say that you know, containment and deterrence works, that there's no rush, there's no need to go to war against Iraq, that there's no threat against the security of the United States of America emanating from Iraq, you should pay attention to this. War should not be about advancing somebody's political ambition. War should be about defending the United States of America.
Thank you.
When you said at the end that you wanted to know what we've been doing, what I want to, as a preface, say that there have been a number of us who have been to Iraq lately who have seen the effects of the sanctions and the war, the Gulf War and all the weaponry that was tossed at them back during the Gulf War and since then. There are at least three of us here who have been there. What I would like to direct your attention to is the fact that we shot up their water system knowing full well, according to a Pentagon study that was done beforehand, that that would lead to gastrointestinal diseases of the children. And I saw that. I saw it. We collapsed their economy so that an Iraqi dinar, which used to be worth $3.50, is now worth one three-thousandth of a dollar. So that when I went to a hospital in Amara, I saw children dying of malnutrition, you know, the bloated bellies. And I, that same doctor, and this is the one that I wanted to mention, is told me that in particularly in southern Iraq, there has been a sevenfold, that's 70%, 700% increase in cancers, particularly in central and southern Iraq. What, because of the depleted uranium shells, you know, the anti-tank weapon that bursts into dust and gets into the environment. We have anecdotal evidence of children bringing in shrapnel from those things and 3 years later into their homes, and 3 years later every child in that family has cancer. What I'd like to see is a weapons inspection program that says, where did this depleted uranium come from? What are we doing to stop it? And go to every particular site in the United States that produced that and produced any system that got it there.
All right. It wasn't a question, but I think there are a lot of points raised. One, economic sanctions. Let's talk about that for just a second because the gentleman raised it. Sounds like a pretty copacetic term, economic sanctions. You know, we're going to contain Iraq through economic sanctions. But like war, it's not that easy. Economic sanctions are responsible for anywhere between 350,000 and 1.5 million deaths in Iraq. Most of those who died were children under the age of five. There was a period of time, 1993, 1994, 1995, where kids were dying off at a rate of 3,000 to 5,000 a month. 3,000 to 5,000 a month. Now, some people say, well, it's Saddam Hussein's fault. He has the key to free the Iraqi people if he just cooperated. But I already told you that James Baker said it didn't matter if they cooperated. Sanctions were going to stay in place until we got rid of Saddam. So we're the ones that closed the door on liberating the Iraqi people, on freeing the Iraqi people. We left this policy in place even though we knew it wasn't hurting Saddam Hussein and that it was eviscerating the Iraqi public, the innocent, the helpless. You know, if we said that our policy is we're going to compel Saddam Hussein to cooperate, and if I said, okay, well, I'm going to send my Marines into Iraq every month, and we're going to scoop up 5,000 children at the age of five and take them to a stadium, and we're going to send Saddam a letter, comply or the kids buy it. And Saddam Hussein comes back and says, stick it in your ear, we're not compliant. So I line up the kids on the wall, I turn to my Marines, say, load the machine guns, ready, aim, fire. Not a single Marine will pull that trigger. Why? Because Marines don't kill kids. Americans don't kill kids. But we do. We did. We slaughtered them. We didn't kill them with bullets. We didn't kill them with bombs. We let them starve to death. We let them die of treatable diseases. And the blood is on all of our hands because this is an American failure. It's a failure of American policy. You know, you can say Saddam Hussein pulled the trigger. It's, well, I'm not trying to give him a clean bill of health. Let's say he's guilty. He's responsible for their deaths. But, you know, if I grab somebody and say, let's go for a drive through downtown Binghamton, you get behind the wheel and say, hey, stop on this corner here. I run into a bank, and I go, hey, give me your, boom, I kill the teller. Boom, I kill the guard. I grab the money. Off we drive. Who's the trigger man? Me. Who's culpable for murder? You, the getaway driver. America has facilitated the deaths of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Iraqis. That's the reality of economic sanctions, and it began with the deliberate targeting of Iraq's civilian infrastructure in 1991. We knew when we bombed their water purification plants, when we bombed their power plants, that there were going to be tens of thousands of deaths coming from that. You know, if we go to war against Iraq today, there's studies already that say that direct combat losses will probably be 50,000 dead Iraqi civilians. 50,000. And then, within 5 months, another 250,000 will die of disease, of malnutrition. So this is what we're talking about when we say go into war with Iraq. You raise depleted uranium. I have to tell you, as a Marine Corps, former Marine officer, my job when I go to war is to bring my Marines home alive. Bottom line. You know, I have a responsibility to the parents of my Marines, to their families, to the American people, that when we go to war, I'm going to bring them home alive if I can. That means if the enemy's out there, I ain't going to fight fair. You got a T-72 tank with reactive armor? Depleted uranium, baby. I'm not going to make this a fair fight. I'm going to call in the strike. We're going to take them out, blow up that tank. You got troops out there? I bring in the A-10. We're going to shoot you up with 30 Mike. Depleted uranium. We're going to slaughter you. We're going to eviscerate you. I'm going to ensure that I kill everybody because my Marines are coming home alive. That is the reality of war. The problem is there's this other reality called what happens when the troops come home. We leave this pollution there. You know, if we're going to go to war and save our Marines by using depleted uranium, we have the moral responsibility to ensure we clean up the mess we made. We have to. And what you say about the Iraqis suffering from cancer, you know, I don't know. You said it's anecdotal. Unfortunately, that's what it is. You know, the World Health Organization tried to go into southern Iraq and do a study of depleted uranium, and the United States government prevented it from happening. We won't allow the facts to come in. And it's not just the Iraqis are suffering. It's our veterans. Our veterans are suffering. Our veterans are the ones who also bring the stuff home. You know, you're a male. You're in combat. You're in an M1 tank. You get hit. You know, the number one killer of M1 tanks in the Gulf War were M1 tanks. And we fired depleted uranium rounds into friendly fire situations, taking out our own tanks. Now, the crew members, you know, we have a great HALON system. So, boom, HALON, they get out. But they sucked in the depleted uranium dust. And these men who served their country came home. And you know where depleted uranium likes to hang out? In the testicles. And you know what happens when they go home and they impregnate their wife? The kids. The kids come out deformed. Little mutated kids. Americans. These are American veterans who gave their life, who put their life on the line for our country. And what are we doing for them? Nothing. We're ignoring this problem. We're saying it doesn't exist. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a travesty. This is a moral stain on the character of the United States of America. You know, and we're getting ready to go to war against Iraq. It's not only did we pollute it the first time, we went to Kosovo and polluted it. We got British soldiers dying from, you know, depleted uranium poisoning. We got Kosovar civilians dying. And now we're going to go back to Iraq and even do it more. No, there's a problem here. We got to stop this war for a number of reasons. We got to stop it for a number of reasons. One of the things that we have to take a look at is, why do we continue to use depleted uranium? Isn't there a better way that doesn't have this kind of long-term, you know, contamination on the environment? This death penalty for countless of generations of not only Iraqis and Kosovars, but Americans as well.
My question goes along those lines. You just said that America doesn't kill kids. I have to disagree with you. America just killed a lot of kids in Afghanistan. My question is that all along your talk, I heard you, you gave us a graphic description of what war means, like in terms of the American soldiers who are 20 years old who are going to be killed and how the bullet enters their bodies. And shouldn't the American people go against this war against Iraq because of the Iraqi people who are going to die, the many women and men who are going to die, not just because of the American, just because George Bush and an imperialist government decided to go to war against Iraq? Thank you.
I think I said that we're talking about a war that's going to kill, you know, 40 to 50,000 people up front and 250,000 people in the 5 months. So I don't think I'm shying away from the horrific, you know, results that the Iraqi people will feel when we go to war. Of course, we should stop, you know, going. We shouldn't go to war because we're going to not only lose American lives, but we're going to kill, you know, many hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. You know, that's the reality. I do think, though, that, you know, when we talk about death, maybe I'm guilty of the same thing. You know, I'm American focused. My loyalties is the United States of America. I want to stop this war, not because I care about the Iraqi people, but because I care about American service members. I care about Americans. I care about the values that this country aspires to. And maybe that's a wrong way of viewing it. But it's tough when you live in the United States. I hate to say it, but we sort of are racist in the way we view the world. You know, we talk about Iraq, 1.5 million dead Iraqis, but they're not really 1.5 million dead Iraqis. They're brown people. You know, there's women wearing veils, and they got the brown babies. And, you know, a brown baby isn't really the same as a white baby. You know, a brown person can't feel the same sorrow and depth of sorrow when they bury their children. And, you know, those Muslims, they have kids by the score. They just have another kid. Unfortunately, that seems to be 1.5 million dead Sudanese. And do we weep for them? Do we weep for the Rwandans? Do we weep for anybody who's not white? No, we have a foreign policy, unfortunately, and we have a tolerance for American foreign policy that sometimes is very racist in its nature. Do you think we'd even tolerate a war with Yugoslavia where we would talk about killing 200,000 white Serbs? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. but we're going to talk about going to war with Iraq and not even blink when we speak of 300,000 dead Iraqis. Not even blink, as though an Iraqi life is not the same as any other life. No, you're right. I apologize. Maybe I came across as a little too callous.
Hi. During the spring and summer of 2001, all I could hear about was the growing red Chinese menace. The PRC was coming, and September 11th happens, and I never hear anything else about China. And I guess what I'm asking is, you were speaking about imperialism earlier. I was wondering if you could relate this to what was seeming to be a setup for war against China just a year ago, and yeah, I'll stop it there.
Okay. Well, what I would say is that, you know, this is just my take on the situation here, but I view what occurred in I'm a Republican, by the way, of conservative, moderate leanings who voted for George W. Bush for president, so I'm not up here with a political axe to grind. But I view what happened after 2000, the 2000 election, as somewhat of a coup d'etat, where you know, neoconservatives who populated think tanks in and around Washington, D.C., who festered under 8 years of Clinton administration rule, took advantage of George W. Bush coming into office. You know, I voted for W. because he said he was a uniter, not a divider. He said he was going to reach across party lines and, you know, bring in Democrats and build a very balanced cabinet, and that he was going to conduct a foreign policy that was based on humility. You know, we're a great power, but we're going to be humble in our application of this power. Maybe he would have done that had he won the election. But the fact is that, you know, while he constitutionally has the office, he didn't get the popular vote, and it was a very narrow margin on the electoral vote. And what happens to a politician when they don't have that kind of mandate? They fall back on their political base. And maybe I should have had a wake-up call during the primary when John McCain was challenging George W. Bush in the state of South Carolina, and I saw what George W. Bush did. He became a far right-wing racist white American. And unfortunately, that's what he is today, a far right-wing racist white American. And he has surrounded himself with neoconservatives who have been espousing certain ideologies. In foreign policy, these people espouse the ideology of imperialism. They call it unilateralism. Paul Wolfowitz, Dick Cheney, in 1992, tried to put forward this policy of American unilateralism that we see today. Now, to do that, you need a threat. You need a threat, and that's where Red China comes in. See, Red China was the threat. Red China allows us to talk about ballistic missiles so we can have a national missile defense system. Red China allows us to abrogate arms control treaties. Red China allows us to do a lot of things. Red China is the boogeyman around which the neoconservatives pursue their narrow-minded vision of American foreign policy, rejection of arms control, rejection of multilateralism, a rejection of international law, the imposition of American unilateral dominance and hegemony of the world. That was what's, you know, it's happened on the domestic front, too. You know, we got John Ashcroft in there using the war on terror, using the fear to assault the Constitution of the United States, to take down the very individual civil liberties that we Americans are supposed to cherish and love. Well, September 11th allowed the president to divert attention from China, because China was always an artificial construct. They weren't really a threat, to come up with a threat called Al-Qaeda. But they cleverly then replaced Al-Qaeda with Iraq. And now we're using Iraq as justification for implementation of this new policy. We're using Al-Qaeda and the war on terror as justification for, you know, the Patriot Act for Homeland Security, for a rejection of the age-old division between prosecutors and intelligence services exchanging information. I just came, you know, I came from Detroit, and I was driven to the airport by an American citizen of Lebanese descent. On September 12th, he was arrested by the FBI and held 27 days incommunicado. His crime? He took flight lessons. An American citizen was held incommunicado for 27 days. He didn't commit a crime. Now, people can say, well, you know, gosh, we were attacked. No, ladies and gentlemen, the second we allow the United States government to treat American citizens in this fashion, to violate the due process of law, we cease to be America.
I would like to congratulate you on what you just said, because I feel very, very strongly about that. I would also like to challenge the audience about an earlier point that you made about the loss of American lives as compared to the loss of foreign lives. When September 11th happened, all I could think of was how outraged we all were that several thousand Americans died, but all I could think of was of the embargoes on Iraq and how many hundreds of thousands of people had died, and how, like, the average American doesn't care at all about anyone else, and then this several thousand people died, and we were so upset, and we're taking such drastic actions, and it's just infuriating to me. I would also like to ask you, you're saying that we as an American people need to band together, and you're saying we need to do something about this. Our voice is not being heard, right? And in a political system that the individual voice is not being heard more and more, and as we're becoming more and more silent, and as, like you said, so many voices were heard against the war and we were ignored. We marched on Washington and no one cares. No one cares. What do we do? I don't know what to do, and I feel very stymied and I don't know what to do.
Yeah, that's the toughest one of all, because I have to tell you I'm up here and maybe I sound cocky and I sound confident, but I'm just as confused as you are. I'm a Marine Corps officer by training. I'm not a political activist. In September, I found myself in London addressing a crowd of 450,000 anti-war demonstrators. The concept of a conservative, Republican, former Marine addressing a half a million anti-war protesters was something I never could have envisioned happening. You say, what can happen? I was given this this document. Two things. There's a protest the war on Iraq gathering on December 5th, Thursday, outside the New University Union at from 12 noon to 3 p.m. That's one way to let your voice be heard. There's a pledge of resistance nationwide call to protest war in Iraq outside the Binghamton Federal Building December 10th from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. That's another way, but, is this really, I think it's great. I think it's a good way for people to come together, but what are you going to do about it after that? Okay, so you have your little demonstration. I've gone out and I've done a lot of work with church groups and religious-based movements, and they have these things called peace vigils, and they like to get together and light candles and hold hands and sing Kumbaya, and the world will be a better place, and then they go home and nothing happens. The world doesn't become a better place. There's a lot of desire out there for peace, a lot of desire, but desire and 40 cents gets you a cup of coffee. There's got to be will. You got to have the will for peace. You have to have the will to take action, the will to do something. These gatherings are great. But what I would say is we're facing a big problem. You say you feel powerless. Well, the second the American people feel powerless means we failed as a democracy, because democracy requires the people to be involved. So the people have to become involved. One of the ways we become involved is the democratic or the election process. But what's going to happen in 2004? You're going to show up at the polling booth and you're going to open it up and you're going to have a ballot. Did you pick the names on the ballot? Or were they picked for you? John Kerry of Massachusetts, the great John Kerry, the brave John Kerry, war veteran, Vietnam War veteran, he's been there, he's done it. He's running for president. Do we really want him? I don't. This guy voted for war. This guy abrogated his constitutional duty to the American public and gave up his obligation to confer about war and gave it to the president. And then he said, I voted for war because I'm against the war. Well, maybe he should be president with that kind of logic. But the point is, you've got 2 years. Unfortunately, I don't think there's much you can do to stop a war with Iraq. I think that the Bush administration is going to go to war, and I think it's going to be horrific, and I think we're going to pay a horrible price for our complacency as an American people. It's a damn shame we haven't learned any lesson from history. I get told today, you can't say what you're saying, Scott. How can you say the president's a liar? Well, he's a liar. I'll say it plain and simple. And the concept of a president lying should not be foreign to the American people. Go back in your history books. 1964, Lyndon Baines Johnson. He lied to the American people about an incident in the Gulf of Tonkin. He said that American warships were attacked by the Vietnamese. Congress gave him war powers authority. 10 years later, 58,000 dead Americans, 2 million dead Vietnamese, and $1 trillion of squandered national treasure, we realized we made a mistake. We've been lied to. You think we would have learned our lesson, but it's happened again. We've been lied to. We've been told there's a threat in Iraq in terms of weapons of mass destruction, and Congress has given the president war powers authority, and ladies and gentlemen, we're going to go to war. All right, fool me once, shame on me, or shame on you. Fool me twice, or maybe shame on me too. Fool me twice, shame on me. Okay, we've been fooled twice. It's time to say we won't be fooled again. I hate to bring up Roger Daltrey, but, you know, maybe we need to. 2004 is a day that is a year that the American people get to elect a new president. The question is, what president are we going to elect? Ralph Nader, maybe, whoever. Go out there and find somebody worth leading this nation. Go find somebody. Don't let the power elites dictate who you're going to have as your choices. You have 2 years to go out and let your voice be heard. Pick somebody, get together, gather together and say, we're going to put a man or a woman in office that's worthy of the title President of the United States of America.
I very much enjoyed the stuff you said about encouraging us to do something and that the blood is on our hands, and I agree with you completely that insofar as we don't act to stop what's happening, that we are in part responsible. But I just wanted you, if possible, to elaborate on something about, I don't know, long-range prospects and more serious things that are feasible for us to do. You had mentioned about how back in the day, in 1770-whatever, that the U.S., the colonists, they overthrew the British and they ended Britain's control of America through British imperialism. And I mean, many people look upon that as a very glorious event. America got independence, etc. But obviously something was not so glorious about that, in that the revolution they had ended up establishing a system and a society that was very much similar to the one that they were supposedly rebelling against. And then nowadays, we have American imperialism, which makes the British and the Italians or the Dutch look like children in comparison to the butchery and the sanctions and the depleted uranium, all the things that the U.S. does. So I just ask you, is there something no longer valid in the techniques that were used back then in terms of revolution, and that the people who carry out these wars and are willing to kill Iraqis, who are willing to kill Americans, how can we persuade them, how can we vote them away when historically it's basically been a matter of war and revolution to get rid of these people? So what can we do? And do you have any thoughts on what's like the political, I don't know, it's like we have a lot of things that we're against that we disagree with that suck, but what is it that we're for? I think that we need to acknowledge that as long as we have a society based upon competition over resources and land and markets, capitalism, that we're not going to have peace and that these wars are inevitable.
Well, I'm getting way over my pay grade if I attempt to answer that one. I'm not a political scientist. What I will say is this, America is not a perfect country. I think we should acknowledge that right up front. We're a nation of human beings, and we have to acknowledge our human foibles and frailties. But you know, we're a damn good country. We're the best country out there, I believe. We stand for good things. We're good people. We stand for individual rights. We stand for freedom. We stand for liberty. And we didn't get this way instantly. You know, it's not as though we had the revolution and suddenly we're this perfect country. Hell, if you go back and read, you know, we had slavery at the end of the Revolutionary War. You know, obviously we had that big issue going on. We had to fight a civil war to emancipate the slaves. Women didn't get the right to vote until over a century and a half later. We still had to have an ugly thing called it's a beautiful thing, but it was ugly, the civil rights movement to actually affirm, you know, the civil liberties of all Americans. And we're still not there. We're still struggling. We're still working. But we stand for something, you know, and what we stand for is embodied in the Constitution, something called the American Republic. And what I would say is that, you know, we have to do something. If we're going to survive as the United States of America, we need to understand that we cannot be an imperial power. We cannot be. That is not the United States. But we are an imperial power, and we have to recognize that. We have transformed ourselves into an imperial power. You know, they say empires die of indigestion. You know, they go out and they consume the world, and then the world destroys them. No empire survives. None. And I guarantee you that if we continue down this path of empire, we will be destroyed. The bottom line. Now, we may call ourselves the United States of America. We may raise the flag. We may take a pledge of allegiance. But the nation will not be the nation that our founding fathers framed when they wrote the Constitution. We're going to have to do something unique in terms of empires. We as an empire are going to have to reject empire. We're going to have to rein ourselves in. We're going to have to accept multilateralism. We're going to have to accept the rule of law. And that's a very difficult thing for an unmatched power to do. But I would tell you that it's the only way the United States of America will be able to survive. If we continue to try and push our weight around, we may call ourselves Americans, but we won't be Americans. And I don't know, where's my clock person? Okay, one more question.
I actually don't have a question. I just wanted to thank you for giving us this open view of yours about the international situation. And I wanted to use that to call us attention to what's happening on the local level. And in this state of paranoia that's somehow apparent here, I'm Austrian. You referred to Adolf Hitler once, like in your speech. And I came here in times that are a little troubled and maybe not the best to not think, like, simplify things too much and think too much in black and white. But, I mean, since I'm alive, I've always heard and thought that this is always, like, ringing in the back of my mind. Never let this happen again, like, referring to Second World War and fascism. And yesterday, a group of students came to a teacher and we were very distressed, truly distressed, and talking about that there's a mosque in Johnson City and that the Muslims are using this as a cover-up to do some conspiracies or whatever to plan another terrorist act, and that the police can't do anything to, can't step in, and why are they doing that, and we didn't do anything to them, so what shall we do? And I just hear the alarm bells like ring in the back of my mind and thinking what happened with synagogues, like some years back in Germany and Austria especially. And I just wanted to use this opportunity to talk about in front of this audience about this. Just, I'm worried if I hear something like that, that there's like conspiracies, the police can't do anything, and that people who are, that people are used for a foreign policy or whatever, and there's a state of paranoia also produced by the media, by this often very wrong news. And that people would take action to their own hands or something, and use a religion for an excuse or whatever, or a mosque as an aim for some strange act. So that's all that I want to say. Thanks.
Okay. Since that wasn't a question, I'll take one more question, and then I guess that would be it.
My question has to do with diplomacy. And maybe it's too theoretical a question to ask in this climate, but I was struck by the fact in your book, Endgame, you listed a number of diplomatic initiatives that you were suggesting, and sort of a principle that you mentioned in that section had to do with giving a person, in this case Saddam Hussein, some wiggle room. That negotiation always involves some wiggle room. So I wonder if you could say something about diplomatic efforts that you wish had happened, and then relate the theme of diplomacy to what you think can be done to try to help the Iraqi people get rid of their dictator that's, you know, nonviolently, diplomatically, or otherwise.
Okay, well, the key to diplomacy is engagement. I mean, you can't have diplomacy if you're not willing to engage, and the fact is the United States has failed to send a diplomatic delegation to Baghdad in the past decade. We just aren't even engaged. I would like to see the United States send a special envoy to Iraq to try and resolve these issues. Again, it may not be the biggest pride booster in the world to say, well, we're going to negotiate our way out of this problem. You know, it feels a lot better to say we're going to go in and blow the bastard away. You know, God, that feels good. But yeah, that only works on TV and in the movies. Going in and blowing the bastard away is about losing Americans. And as I said, that's the last thing I'm willing to stand by idly and let happen. I love my Marines more than I hate Saddam Hussein. I'll tell you that much. No, we need to negotiate. We need to go in and basically, you know, define what it is we want to have accomplished in Iraq. We want to get rid of weapons of mass destruction. So be it. That's one of the conditions. Iraq has to submit to weapons inspections. They're doing that now. We want improved human rights in Iraq. So be it. But I'll tell you, the best way to improve human rights in Iraq is to lift economic sanctions. That's the best way. And you want to talk about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. What I would say is this. We have to stop viewing Iraq, a nation of 23 million people, in the person of one man, Saddam Hussein. Get rid of Saddam Hussein. What's that mean? Do we, you know, we talk about the democratization of Iraq. Well, do we really want democracy in Iraq? I mean, it's curious. When I say we, I'm talking about our elected representatives. You know, democracy would mean giving power to 60% of the Iraqi population who are Shia Muslims. We really want to give power to the world's second largest proven reserves of oil to the Shia, who are theocratically aligned with the mad mullahs of Tehran? No, I don't think so. So we're not talking about democracy, are we? We really want to empower 23% of the population who are Kurds and give them a Kurdish homeland? That flies in the face of our NATO allies, Turkey. So we're not talking about democracy in Iraq. We're talking about empowering less than 17% of the population who are Sunni Muslims. And even the Sunnis are not, you know, homogeneous in their makeup. Iraq is a very tribal society, And the Sunni tribes, you know, they're competing amongst one another for dominance. It was like if you go to The Godfather and that scene where Don Corleone has called all the Italian families together and you open up the door and, you're an outsider, you go, wow, the Italians, they get along so great. Look at them all sitting around the table eating together. But the fact is they murder each other. They compete. They connive. They stab until one family emerges dominant. And that's what happens in Iraq. It's a tribal society. The Sunnis dominate. They dominate through fear and intimidation. And even amongst the Sunni tribes, they fight amongst each other till one tribe emerges dominant. Saddam Hussein is a tribal leader. If you eliminate Saddam Hussein, understand that you keep in place the internal domestic political dynamic that produced Saddam Hussein. And you will get somebody who will be about the same height with a black mustache and a black beret. He won't be called Saddam Hussein, but he'll rule Iraq in the exact same fashion. That's the reality of the situation. It's not about getting rid of Saddam Hussein. It's about changing the internal dynamic of Iraq so they stop producing as Saddam Hussein. And the best way to do that is to lift the economic sanctions and liberate the economy of Iraq so that the Iraqi people can develop, stunningly enough, something called a viable middle class. We want democracy in Iraq. Study history. What's the basic building block for democracies? A viable middle class. Economic reconstruction in Iraq will empower the Iraqi people to change the internal domestic political dynamic of Iraq in a way that they don't produce someone like Saddam Hussein. And you know, no Americans had to die to achieve that. That's how I would proceed with Iraq. And okay, thank you very much. It was a pleasure being here tonight.
You've been listening to a talk given by Scott Ritter on December 3rd in Binghamton, New York. Thanks to Heather Dunbar of WSKG for providing us with this tape. Ithaca Community Radio will be holding our first public meeting for dialogue with the community on the goals of the project and how we may achieve them. The meeting will be held on Saturday, December 14th from 11 to 1 in the Borg Warner Room of the Tompkins County Public Library, located at the corner of Green and Cayuga Streets in downtown Ithaca. We hope to see you there.
Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guest is produced by Chris Sir, Jesse Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. Now, my goodness.